The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Our next guest this morning has been in business since he was a teenager. Nick Corcoran's career brought him from street trading to Wall Street trading, working with Dermot Desmond, and he had an international career with Zurich Capital Markets. In time, he realised he wanted to work for himself. Together with Nigel McDermott, he set up Cardinal Capital Group. They're well known for their investment in Bank of Ireland, with Wilbur Ross back in 2011, and for buying stakes in Irish companies like Lily O'Brien's Chocolates, Payzone and AA Ireland. Nick, there's probably a fairly typical career path to working as a trader, but you have a different story. Tell me a bit about where you grew up.
It was very atypical, and even speaking to investors now, and we speak to a lot of international investors, and I do have to define the fact that I'm not a classic MBA business graduate that evolved into a career in finance. I grew up in the inner city of Dublin, which around originally in Constitution Hill, then moved on to Dorset Street. I've always lived the first 20 years of my life in the inner city. When I left school, which was probably in the mid-80s, the world was a very different place then. I think unemployment in Ireland was somewhere in the region of 16%, which was extraordinary, because if you look at even in the heights of the financial crisis recently, we didn't reach those levels. So when you look at what your opportunities are at that point, you have to be a little bit creative and a little bit self-inventive. So I was involved in a lot of interesting things at the time. I bought and sold vegetables from the fruit market in the centre of Dublin, around just around George's Hill School.
What age were you at that stage?
Oh, probably about 14, 15 at that stage.
And was that a job, or did you decide, I think I could make a few quid here doing this myself?
It was a little bit of, I wanted to be self-sustaining. You know, my parents are great, they work hard, but you know, we needed the money, I needed the money, so it was a self-sustaining aspect. And then that evolved. We actually graduated to big time, Richard. We ended up running a van shop in Ballymun, amongst the towers in Ballymun, which at that point was a big step up, and a great life experience, and very interesting. And then we actually sold clothes on the Palmerstown shopping or Palmerstown markets, in terms of what other diversity we could bring to the our own projects and what we could do and how we could make money. So that was all a precursor.
The van shop in Ballymun, I don't know, particularly in the 1980s and all that, it sort of conjures up images of Ruddy Doyle films and things like that. It must have been, I'd say, a fairly tough way to make a few quid, but interesting all the same.
It was fascinating, and even in mentioning it, you feel like you're a character that jumped out of Roddy Doyle's books, and they're great books. If you look at The Van and The Snapper, they're fantastic movies and books. But it was real life. It was really interesting. And I think one of the things that struck me in places like Ballymun and place where we went, it was the community and the focus on people there making a living and getting by. And the one thing it introduced me to was probably the first introduction to credit. That what we did was actually provide credit to the locals in terms of their weekly, whether it was benefit checks or paycheck. And that really just opened your eyes to a whole different environment, that people needed that to get by.
Did you always get paid?
Generally, yes. We had very good credit policies and credit selection. So usually they were a good profile, and it worked pretty well.
But at some point along the way, while all this is going on for you, you're looking beyond your immediate environment. You're looking beyond the inner city. You're thinking about finance. You're thinking about job. You seem to know fairly early on what you wanted to go into.
Oh, I was a bit of a geek when it came to financial systems and the world. And if you probably remember, but in the 80s, in the mid to late 80s, you had the movie Wall Street, which was actually prolific at that time. It was one of the big focuses on the world's financial markets. I found that fascinating.
Michael Douglas.
Exactly. Really, really interesting movie. I loved the whole concept, the glamour, the attraction of it. And I loved numbers. And I was working with money. I was working in a much more lower scale of it. And I figured I have to find a way to do that. And it was also at a time which was about, I think, Black Monday, which was the collapse of the global stock markets. So all of this was in the headlines. You could see.
But Michael Douglas, as I remember in that film, he shafted the trade unions, didn't he?
He did, and I took a lesson from that always, to actually support the workers.
So Wall Street, the movie, left an impression on you?
It certainly created an interest and an awareness. So I would go off and I would read a little bit more about these things and figure out, how do we do this? What is involved? what influences does it drive and what does it achieve more so? And at that stage then I decided it's probably time to get a proper job and I should get an education, because at that stage I'd finished my Leaving Cert. I can't quite recall the exact year, it was probably late 80s, mid 80s. As I described, not really an ideal time to go looking for a job, and certainly not walk into one as glamorous as trading. So I applied to AIB and I actually succeeded in taking a job with them for my first real job, as I call it. And that's probably doing a disservice to what I did before that from 14 onwards, which was much more interesting and colourful. I started out as a bank teller in AIB for 2 years in Leixlip. And I think I broke a lot of the protocols there, because the first thing I wanted to do when I started out was get into their trading room and be a trader and a dealer. So I started writing off to all and sundry in AIB, and I think was summoned to the manager's office at one stage and say, what are you doing here? This is not how it happens. And I said, oh, well, I didn't know that, but this is how I make it happen. And I ended up working in their trading room, which was fantastically exciting. It was just before the ERM crisis or the exchange rate crisis.
Was your background and buying and selling at an early age, did that make you better at how you did your job in the bank?
I think, I'm not sure I would describe it as the buying and selling making it better. I think what I was fascinated with was the psychology of markets and what drove people. Why were they afraid to take different positions and perspectives? And I found that fascinating, because it really wasn't just about the buying and selling the numbers. It was the drivers behind it. What prompted people to buy? What prompted them to sell? Why did people behave in a certain way? And particularly the crowd mentality. That was something that I was intrigued with, which is, why does everybody follow one particular path, when really there's probably a different perspective that can be taken that can be quite rewarding? And that's the path that interested me.
So you went to work in Dermot Desmond's NCB, and that had, am I right in saying that Dermot Desmond and NCB had been on your mind or on your horizon before that? Because you'd actually written a letter years earlier. What happened there?
Yes, I did. You're well researched, actually, Richard, because I think when I was around 14, 15, and I was first exposed to financial markets and trading, and I looked at our own domestic base, and one of the most, biggest impact firms at that point was Dermot Desmond's NCB, and I found that really interesting. So I wrote to him, and not only him, I actually wrote to all the directors of NCB at the time.
And I said, you were 14?
I might have just been about 15, 15. 16, something like that. And I said, I'd like a job. I need to come work for you. I need to get into this space. And so Dermot, I think, was more amused than anything else. I think he then called me and I had a coffee with him. And he said, look, go away, get some experience, get an education, come back to me. So I decided I'd go off, and I was going to get an education anyway. I think I'd come to that conclusion myself, that I better go off and do something interesting. So I did. And having had a fantastic career in derivatives trading, which I really enjoyed, your mid-20s, you're trading global currencies, you're in the middle of global events. It was fascinating. I then thought, well, what's next? What am I going to do next? And I wanted to broaden my skills. I wanted to go international, and I wanted to get exposure to different types of investment. And so at that point, I think Dermot had been very successful, sold NCB and set up another company, which I joined. And I joined because I wanted to get exposure to direct investing.
In Ireland, the crash came along 2008. By 2009 and 2010, the country is up in a heap. The banking system is banjaxed. Cardinal really surfaced in people's minds here when you put together a consortium which bought into and invested in Bank of Ireland. Part of that consortium was American billionaire Wilbur Ross and Prem Watsa, his Fairfax Group, and Cardinal put the deal together. It was an incredible deal because there was an opportunity there to make a lot of money, and those investors made, I think, something like 900 million euro from Bank of Ireland in the space of 3 years. Is that, to use the phrase that's commonly used now, is that vulture capitalism, Nick?
Well, Richard, it was a great opportunity to lose a lot of money as well. And I think that's the starting point when you look at it. And yes, we had a very successful investment in Bank of Ireland. It was fascinating. It was interesting to work on the investment. Wilbur is a great partner. We made about just under 3 times our money on the investment. So it was a very profitable investment. But if you put that into context of where Ireland was at that point, you had AIB nationalised, you had Anglo-Irish Bank nationalised, Irish Permanent was nationalised, EBS was nationalised, all at the expense of the Irish taxpayer. And these events were, and I guess the outcome was probably essential and was something that was going to happen in terms of a burden on the taxpayer because it was the only route out. Whereas for Bank of Ireland, we could provide an alternative route, and that was we could bring international capital, we could save a burden on the taxpayer, and we could take a risk that may or may not pay off.
Was the flip side, though, that there was 900 million in the space of 3 years, 900 million of value that could have gone to the taxpayer, because you guys were able to buy the shares at 9 cent, Wilbur Ross sold at 28 cent. That's a hell of an increase that perhaps could have gone to the taxpayer instead of to Wilbur Ross.
Well, I think the taxpayer had enough exposure to the banking sector and owning practically every other bank in the country. And I think if you talk to the taxpayer as to, you know, where they'd like to deploy their money, I don't think it would be in another bank at that point.
And it's interesting, I suppose, when you look at the share price of Bank of Ireland, the bank came through all of that crisis. The investors sold out. It's listed on the stock market. But the share price, Wilbur sold out at 28 cent. I think it's around half that now.
We had
timing is everything.
Timing is everything, and perception. We Wilbur Ross was a partner with Cardinal. We entered and exited at the same time.
Did Cardinal, you yourselves, make a lot of money out of the Bank of Ireland deal? I don't think it's out there, is it, as to how many shares you guys bought yourselves?
No, it's not, and I like it that way. I think we always have a position which is to focus on the institution we invest in and on our investors. You know, for us as individuals, we try to keep that in the background as much as possible so it doesn't become a distraction, that we focus on delivering some real value for our institutional investors, one of which, by the way, currently today is the Irish taxpayer. As one of the biggest investors in our private equity fund. And I'm really proud to say that any of the returns we make actually are passed back into the Irish taxpayer.
Wilbur Ross, how did you meet him?
Wilbur was introduced. The world's a very small place, Richard. If you look at connectivity, I had started out in Zurich Capital Markets. We had evolved and we had a really interesting joint venture with Rupert Murdoch in Asia. He had introduced me to a great friend of his in the United States that I'd worked with. And then I met Olivier Sarkozy, who was the head of financial services group in Carlisle. And he had worked with in the banking system in Ireland and globally. And we met Wilbur over dinner one night, discussed the opportunities in global banking.
Was Sarkozy anything to the former French president? No?
I believe he's half-brother, yes.
Half-brother, right.
Yeah. But I think once we met with Wilbur, I found that fascinating. If you recall, I had discussed being a bit of a geek when I was 13, 14. I used to follow his career. I used to follow his investments in railroads, in shipping, in financial services. He's one of these old big industrialist names that if you were as focused as I was, you would have known about.
What were you reading, Nick? Because there was no internet in those days. How would you find out about what Wilbur Ross was investing in?
Down the ILAC library. And basically going down and finding out what's going on in the world. There's no subscriptions, there's no internet. But you can be pretty resourceful, and I think you have to give credit to Dublin City Council and their library system. It's a very rewarding place if you look hard enough.
I used to go down to the ILAC library and borrow records, vinyl records. I should have been reading about Wilbur Ross, obviously.
but Wilbur's a great character. I found it fascinating for a number of reasons. He's well known, he's seasoned. I think at this point he's probably around 78, 79. And for me, that was also another instruction in life, which is there's no such thing as retirement at 65 and 60.
So when Wilbur Ross popped up as business secretary in Donald Trump's administration, were you surprised at that, given how you know him, his personality, his views? And he's also kind of survived as business secretary. So many of the Trump hires have left or been fired.
I'm not at all surprised that Donald Trump called on Wilbur. He's a very experienced individual.
Will they be like-minded, do you think?
I try not to push too much on the politics over our dinners because we tend to have differing views on policies and politics. I'd be a lot more liberal, I think, than the Republican base. I'm not at all surprised he's been one of the longest survivors in the cabinet. He's a very smart operator. He has a lot of value to bring, and I hope at some point we can get him back to Ireland and look at something different as his career progresses and into the future.
So with a guy like Wilbur Ross, if you don't talk about politics, maybe for good reason or obvious reasons, what do you talk about?
Why he made certain investments, what drove him, and what were the motivations in his life I think, and also the lessons he learned from the various different jurisdictions and geographies he operated in, and really just to understand and meet an interesting person. It's, you can always learn something from anybody you meet for the first time, and that's always been my philosophy, which is no matter who you meet, you can learn something. You can find something interesting.
And Rupert Murdoch?
Rupert, oh, a ball of energy.
You also have an investment fund described, it's aimed at property development. It's described as a mezzanine fund. For those who aren't used to mezzanine finance, it kicks in, I suppose, when you have, let's say, developers who can borrow a certain amount of what they need from the bank. They have to come up with the rest themselves. They don't have the rest. So you come along and you can provide that gap for them. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's a great description, Richard. It's spot on. And I think what we will do is we will provide that higher risk capital. And we will be a catalyst or a kickstart for projects that wouldn't otherwise happen. And I think if you go back to 2007 and a developer walked into a bank and had a 100 million project, the bank would probably lend him 101 million to cover his costs and everything with it, which was insane and created a situation that we saw ultimately beyond 2008 and onwards. What we do is we will match the risk with the capital. And I think that's a better, more sustainable approach to development and financing in Ireland. And it's something, again, that we're quite proud of. It was the first fund established in that area. It's been very successful. We've had gross lending of over 600 million from Fund One. We financed almost 1,000 residential units with another 8,000 in planning. We also were instrumental in kickstarting the development of what's now the Facebook headquarters in Europe. We've worked with public-private partnerships with Dublin City Council and social housing. It's had a great reach and a great impact.
So much of the publicity around housing and the housing crisis now, the headlines are dominated by what these very large international funds are doing, such as completely buying up sites, you know, or buying up finished apartment blocks and buy to rent and so forth. But am I right in saying what you're doing is actually aiming more at Irish developers who need that bit of extra cash to build on what they already have?
We will work with the best developer, not necessarily just Irish developers. It's a very difficult market to address in the short term. If you recall, you know, we had no construction and housing for probably a period of six, seven years during the crisis. And inevitably, as our economies recover, that's created a shortage in housing. If you look at it more as an economy-wide challenge, it's not something that's going to be addressed quickly. It's going to take some long-term solutions. And in the private housing market, I think we're also going through a structural change in the market where it's more of a professional landlord. And that professional landlord inevitably will have large holdings and will be a mass market landlord. And in a way, that can help improve the market, improves the quality of tenancies, improves the quality of the actual residents themselves. I think supply and demand will eventually equate that market. Supply, as we can see, and we're financing a lot of the supply, will come on stream. And I think that will alleviate some of the rental pressures in the private market.
Do you think it will inevitably take time? What do you see as the big solutions that could or should be applied in the market that are not being applied right now?
I think, again, I would look at the difference between private housing and social and public housing. I believe that the supply coming on stream will ultimately address the issues in the private housing market. I'm also supportive of some of the restrictions around borrowing and consumer borrowing, because part of the issue in the financial crisis we saw was over leverage. There may be some room to relax those restrictions a little bit and create some more affordability for the private housing market. Where I think there needs to be a slightly different approach, though, is in social housing and public housing policy. I personally am a fan of national and local government owning the housing stock and developing the housing stock. I think it creates more of a long-term solution. It creates and is conducive to creating community. And it also is a place where it's best, that they're best serving the public and the demand, which is those that are vulnerable or those that are priced out or disenfranchised by the private market because of the cost and their earnings. And I think that's where the state and the local government has a role to play.
Now, you talked about how you started off when you were very young selling fruit near where you were from in the north inner city in Dublin. In a way, you may be going back to some familiar territory there, because I read that you've submitted a bid. Dublin City Council is looking for bids to redevelop the old fruit market between Capel Street and Smithfield. I don't know, is it the Smithfield market, or how should I refer to it?
I'm glad you asked me that, because I grew up beside a market. I went to school in George's Hill, which is actually, as an aside, is a unique little school right beside the market, where the playground is on the roof of the school looking down on the market. I grew up there. I went to school every day passing the market, passing the forklift trucks and all the noise and smells that you would get in that environment. It's wonderful. And that part of Dublin for me is really close to my heart. I went there every Christmas with my father picking up turkeys. You could see all of the activity and all the life around that market. And it's a shame that it's really evolved into something now which is a bit of a shell of its former self. So the article is correct. To a certain degree, we have not yet submitted a tender for the market, but we will.
What would you like to do with it? Turn it into what?
We want to create something authentic that's really focused on Dublin. It's focused on community and it's focused on independent food producers. It's also a big commitment. My husband Brendan has given up a high-flying legal career to lead the project. We've assembled a huge team of international experts and we will deliver a great submission.
This would be a sort of a personal venture for you rather than necessarily something out of Cardinal or any other investment funds, and your husband Brendan is involved. He's giving up his day job in order to do it, so that's a big commitment, isn't it?
It's pretty big. We certainly won't have any involvement from our funds. They're completely distinct, but certainly from a Cardinal principal perspective, my own individual commitment, yes, I will be driving it. He made a huge commitment. He's equally as passionate. Part of our major pastime is travelling and food, along with my daughter Aoife. She's 20 and still likes spending some time with us, which is unusual. So while she continues to do that, we'll continue to travel. So yes, it's a big commitment. Maybe it was because of the fact that he knew my views for the legal profession and lawyers are well known, and he decided he better change into something a bit more creative, and that's what he followed through.
Your husband Brendan is involved, and your daughter as well. You got married quite recently, did you?
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
It wasn't legal before that, so I think that certainly helped things along the way.
It sounds like from the outside as a recipe for something that was a complex situation for you in the past to evolve to where it is now?
Life itself is complex, I think, Richard. There's always challenges in life. We've created what I call a very modern family. And in a modern family, living in a modern world, you have different challenges and different outlooks. We enjoy the outlooks. I think you always learn from your experiences. And I think what we'd like to do is actually put those experiences to the benefit, not just of my company and just of the investments we make, but also the community in the city. And hence the Market Project is a perfect conduit for that.
From a career point of view, Nick, you mentioned about when you were quite young, reading about various investors, Wilbur Ross and people like that, and what they were doing. In the business world today, who are you reading about? Who do you admire? Who are you watching?
Well, according to the article during the week on the market, as you refer to, I'm a veteran now, so I guess it probably leaves me with a bereft group of equal veterans that I can read about. But what I really enjoy is watching and reading about technology evolution and young entrepreneurs, and I'm really passionate about supporting young entrepreneurs, so I find that's my most interesting space right now.
Nick Corcoran, Cardinal Capital, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.